reform, the legalization of marijuana, or women's rights, the people's issues are covered on these airways. So stay tuned for the best in leading-edge progressive ideas and analysis. And remember to support independent media financially.
Are you tired of think tank-approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So we've been talking about the banking situation. And again, this to me is, this is deregulation on steroids. This is something, predictable. You know, when you allow these situations to happen, you know it's going to. Now, the fallout's very interesting to me. Because the right has taken the position, you know, this is the woke culture. It's woke. It's because we're going to invest in solar panels and all of this. And I love the guy who's the treasurer in Utah. He says that this ESG, because we're going to go after that, too. That's part of Satan's plan. You know, worrying about the environment, worrying about social policy and corporations and social governance and good corporate governance. Somehow it's part of the evil Satan plan. We are in such a screwy world, I'll tell you that. Here to share some thoughts on where we are, where we need to go, and what we can do to maybe turn things in the right direction. I've asked my good friend Doug Jones to come share some thoughts. Doug's a former senator from the great state of Alabama. Doug, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, as always, it's great to be with you, and it is kind of a crazy world we're in these days.
So let's start with the banking situation. What's your gut telling you on this? I mean, I don't like the idea that we have to bail these banks out and be the backstop every time these bankers put themselves in a situation where they're going to collapse our economy. But I know we don't really have a choice. But I want to get your thoughts.
Well, first of all, Rick, I don't see this as a bailout. Not like we had back in 2008, 2009, when we, you know, all of these financial institutions, GM, everybody, needed federal government money to come in and literally prop up the company. In the case of the Silicon Valley Bank, in the case of Signature, what the president and the Treasury Department have done is just to guarantee depositors are going to get their money. But the investors, the bank itself, may or may not survive. The depositors will get their money. That's not a bailout. That's a rescue. That is, you know, these investors, they invested knowing that there was risk. The depositors were putting their money there. And yeah, there were some were startups, some were companies, some were individuals. And they had nothing to do, in my view, with what happened at the bank. But the officers, I think some regulators may have done this, have been asleep at the switch. We'll see. But one of the things that has really kind of struck me is that everybody in the first 48, 72 hours are starting to jump to conclusions about what happened. And we really don't know exactly what happened. We saw some things coming, obviously, that I think were missed. But people are jumping to conclusions. They're going to political corners. And the president said it best. We need a full accounting. We need to have an investigation. The Fed is going to do it. The FDIC is going to do it. The OCC is going to do it. The Treasury Department is going to do it. The Senate Banking Committee and our friend Sherrod Brown is going to do it. There's going to be a full accounting of what happened. And once you understand and see what happens, then I think you can look at potential legislation or other regulations to try to see if there was a way to stop it. And sometimes there's a way to stop it, Rick, and sometimes there's just not.
Right.
People are just no damn good sometimes, and you can't stop greed all the time.
No, you're absolutely right. Now, I look at Missouri Representative Blaine Luchtmeyer, who yesterday said that we need to extend this federal insurance to all depositors going for the next year, 6 months, a year, whatever. And this is where I start going, how deep does this go? And my concern is that this then becomes a bailout because the taxpayer is always the backstop in these situations.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it seems to me, and I may be wrong, there are certain banks that could be teetering a little bit. They put too much money in bonds. The bond market, they did not foresee this inflationary period coming, and the higher interest rates, which causes the bond market to just drop like a rock. So they, I think there are some banks that overextended, but whether or not they'll need help to survive, it remains to be seen. I mean, I you know, the thing that's happening today over in Europe with Credit Suisse, that's a whole different issue with those guys. They've been in trouble for years and been teetering around. What I think we've got are banks right now that are some are a little wobbly. I think the feds are looking at it very closely. Hopefully we're not going to get into that kind of situation. The insurance to, money right now is paid for by these banks. Now, ultimately, they pay for it out of their profits from their customers. But the fact is, we're a long way, I think, right now from potentially seeing any kind of serious bailouts where federal taxpayers' dollars directly are having to go to prop these folks up. The one thing that I believe that, that this administration, and at least the Senate, and I can't say so much for the House, but the Senate, they're gonna want to see officers and directors and investors take the hits before we ever spend real taxpayer dollars.
That's what I want to see. Look, at the end of the day, you know, my problem with all of these things, you go back to, you know, when all of these moments where banks do things and however you want to put it, being irresponsible, being criminal, however you want to frame that, you never see them on the street corner with their tin cup and selling pencils. It's right. Always, you know, it's always the working people who take it on the chin. And I want to believe this time is going to be different.
No, I agree. And I think, you know, Rick, I think the system is different. After the meltdown in 08 and 09, you had a number of things to put in place that stabilized the system. There is a lot more liquidity in the financial markets and in these banks now than there was in 2008. I don't think that that systemic risk exists like it has done in the past. I could be wrong. I am, you know, that banking is not something I do on a day-to-day basis.
Right.
So I could be wrong about a lot of this, but I don't think so. Everything I'm seeing from experts, economists, bankers, others in the financial sector, or so we're in a lot different position than we were 15 years ago or so, and I think we're going to be fine. It's going to be rocky for the investors in those bank stocks for a little bit.
And I saw, you know, today that Senator John Tester wrote a letter to the FDIC people saying that he wants the bonuses because, you know, the appearance of this just looks really, really bad that the executives of this Silicon Valley Bank took bonuses, you know, hours before the announcement that they were sinking, that he wants to see those clawed back.
Absolutely.
Me, I say, yeah, we should be clawing them back. And also we should be giving them a nice shiny set of bracelets.
No, I think, you know, DOJ has opened an investigation. The SEC has opened an investigation. DOJ's is going to be a criminal investigation. There are all manner, SEC, insider trading. Those are criminal, you know, those are crimes. And so that's what I'm saying, though. We need to let this play out and let these investigators get to the bottom of what happened. Because it appears to me that they saw the handwriting was on the wall. They saw some things coming. And they contributed to the problem that occurred in the last 48 hours. And the other thing, Rick, that is a different world that I think people are going to have to kind of adjust to, and including the regulators. This is not, you know, this is not the old, you know, the old Christmas movie, you know, where the bank runs and you got long lines of people coming out there. This bank lost 40-something billion dollars in a matter of minutes. I mean, people drawing money left and right. So we've got to make some adjustments along those lines, too, to ensure that we can't, that a bank can't go insolvent simply with people clicking on a button within a matter of an hour.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because, you know, the reality is virtually any bank could fail given a run of this kind of magnitude. And you know, there's the conspiracy theory, and I don't generally dance in conspiracy worlds, but, you know, this situation with Peter Thiel, you know, leading this withdrawal, did he know something that nobody else knew? And he pulled all his money out, which had all the other vulture capitalists pulling their money out. Was this, you know, as someone pointed out to me, payback for, you know, this SVB being mean to Trump in the past? I don't know. But this triggered kind of a run, didn't it?
It absolutely did. I mean, there was, if you look at the chronology of events, things can happen quickly. And you know, Rick, when you're a startup, when you're in a small business and you're trying to make a go of it, and you see stuff like that, you get scared. You know, I can't blame some of these folks, but you know, that's what these investigators are going to find out. There is going to be an electronic paper trail of all of that. There's going to be emails. There's going to be text messages. There's going to be WhatsApp messages. There's going to be any number of things that I think that they will be able to determine. It may take a little bit. It's not going to be, you know, next week before all this comes out, but I think that they will get to the bottom of it. And if there are those that contributed to this for whatever reason, and they did it knowingly, then their heads ought to roll too. They need to be put under the microscope, just like those officers and directors.
Because I think there's got to be a show here. I think there've got to be perp walks. There's got to be there's got to be a consequence. And I know the president said there's going to be full accountability. I don't know what that looks like because I've never seen it before.
Well, there has been accountability in the past with banks failing, with financial crimes. I'm not a fan of perp walks. I got to be honest with you. I just think I don't think that does that much for the public. I think it just does everything to make the prosecutors feel worthy. I'm not a fan of that, but I do believe that they are going to look very closely at criminal activity, and they will bring those charges. And those are going to be very serious charges. When you get into a federal court system, when the sentencing guidelines, and they're only the guidelines, but they're going to be based on the value of the loss or potential gain, you're talking about some really serious stuff in a system in which parole is not recognized anymore. So I think we're a long way to go, and I imagine that there are some people very, very, very concerned, and they hope they took some of those bonuses and stocks and paid some good lawyers, because they're damn sure going
to
need.
There you go. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with former Alabama Senator Doug Jones. I also wanted to get your thoughts on some of the attacks going on right now. Is that this is all happening because of woke? It's woke culture. It's all the woke policies. We're going to put solar panels on stuff because evidently a number of these startups were in green energy and new technology. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's absurd. It's laughable. I mean, look, I go back to where some of the conversations that you and I had back during the campaign and during the midterms, when the radical right, the Republicans that were running against the president and good, solid Democrats could not come up with policies. So they just created a woke boogeyman. And that's all that is. Everything is woke. I mean, if something happens, anything happens in the country right now, they're going to decry that it's a woke policy, a woke this or woke that, when they don't even know what the hell they're talking about. They don't know what it means at all. It's just a rallying cry for a boogeyman. And that's going to happen. It's the most absurd thing I've ever seen. The woke, if there is a problem with this bank, it's going to be, I believe, because you had some greedy officers and you had some regulators that might have been asleep at the switch. I don't know that for a fact, but everything we're seeing is showing some real serious stuff that was going on within that bank that was leading to this, and why the regulators couldn't grab it, why they didn't see it. That's what I think Congress has to look at, and if there was something they could have done to change it.
I'll tell you, I feel a lot more confident having Joe Biden in the Oval Office and his people in charge of the Department of Justice than I think I would have felt with Donald Trump. But that's just my opinion.
I totally agree with you about that. And I feel better that this investigation from the congressional standpoint is going to be conducted with Sherrod Brown as the chairman up there on the Senate Banking Committee. And they're going to give it a full, fair, and very thorough look and an investigation.
There you go. Well, can you stick around during the break? I got to take a quick break right here.
Absolutely.
I'm going to take a quick break right back on the other side with former Alabama Senator Doug Jones. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Still waiting to hear where Democrats are going to hold their convention for 2024. I know where the Republicans are going to have theirs in Milwaukee. Interesting choice. I personally think Atlanta would be a great place. And I know my listeners in Chicago are going, Chicago would be the perfect place, and Chicago would be a good place. Chicago would be an awesome place. But I think this election cycle, Atlanta would be the place, especially considering the fact that President Jimmy Carter is on probably his last days. It just seems like everything is moving in a direction where Atlanta should be. That's why I've asked our good friend, former Alabama Senator Doug Jones, to stick around and share some thoughts. He's working on a committee to make sure that, well, that convention gets to Atlanta. Senator, appreciate you sticking around.
Sure. I'm glad to do it and appreciate you bringing up Atlanta and the DNC convention. We've been working hard at it.
So I'm looking at this, and I think Atlanta would be a perfect place. It's a state that's gone blue for the last couple elections for senator. This is a chance to make a huge statement. You know, Republicans do this. They go into blue areas. This is a chance for Democrats to kind of do the same thing. But more importantly for me, it's that kind of messaging of, you know, Jimmy Carter's not going to be around much longer. There's that kind. I just think there's something there.
Rick, I totally agree. I mean, as you would expect, I totally agree. The combination of things for Atlanta right now that favor their being selected as the site, to me, are just overwhelming. It includes the fact that the South is going to be, in my view, and I've said this for a long time, you and I have talked about this before, the South is going to be where the Democratic Party can grow. It's going to take some time. But it's where persuadable voters are. It's where people are that are not always bent to these culture wars. It's pretty solid Republican right now. But you can see with what happened in Georgia that it's changing. You know, we had glimpses of it with my race in 2017. You see that time and time again. I'm telling you, we can win this governor's race in Mississippi. That's coming up in 23. So the South is a place that you got to go and you got to be persuadable voters. And the message that Democrats have on all the kitchen table issues, on all of those things that are important, are right there for the taking in the South. And you go there and you give that message, and it helps spread that word throughout the Southern states. And that's where the growth can be with the Democratic Party. Now, the second thing, as you mentioned, is both President Carter and civil rights, and they go hand in hand. But, you know, Atlanta is really the heart of the civil rights movement. And it's not just black and white. It has gone beyond that into LGBTQ. It is into all manner of civil and human rights. But it started right there with black and white and Dr. King, John Lewis, the history there. And that has been the heart of the Democratic Party now. You know, it was Jim Crow Democrats in the day. But it has been the base of the Democratic Party right there in Atlanta. You know, and Atlanta is in Georgia have moved into a swing state. It is one that we need to win again in 2024. And the place where this convention will be, Rick, a lot of people don't know this. You know, that there is a polling place there. And Joe Biden won that polling place for like 40,000 votes. And he only won Georgia by 11,000. So there are the political things. There's the historical things. And I do think, you know, God bless him. There is no one that the South should be prouder of than Jimmy Carter. You know, did was his presidency perfect? Absolutely not. But like the I was talking about civil rights, Jimmy Carter was a New South governor and a president from the South who turned the pages on Jim Crow. He is the one that in the state of Georgia started hiring more blacks, started putting people on the payroll. He did that as president. He really turned that page and was something to be proud of. He's remembered so much for his post-presidency, but for somebody like me that grew up yearning for New South-type governors to come around in the late 60s and 70s, Jimmy Carter led the way, and there were others. There were Dale Bumpers in Arkansas and some, but Jimmy Carter became president, and he practiced what he preached. That's the thing. He never wavered. He got beat for governor in 1966 by arch segregationist Lester Maddox. And instead of trying to mold to in that mold of Lester Maddox, he stayed true to what he believed. He's was a man of faith, still a man of faith. And I think it would be the perfect opportunity for the Democratic National Committee to say, yeah, it's time to go back to Atlanta. We hadn't been there since 1988.
Yeah, it seems like the right moment. And again, I know this is I've got listeners. I know the emails are going to fill up with my friends from Chicago going, no, it should be Chicago. And look, Chicago's a great place. But I just think historically speaking, this moment, this is kind of it. So do you have a sense of I know you guys have been working on a campaign. Do you have a sense of maybe where this is going to go?
You know, right now, it really is going to, I think, is depends on one guy, and that's Joe Biden. This is his convention, and he's going to weigh it. I think that, both Atlanta and the other cities have done what they needed to with the DNC to make sure that all the requirements are satisfied. I think Atlanta, logistically, I think is heads and above everybody else because you can most every delegate will be able to walk to the convention and not have to ride buses. But I think at the end of the day, Rick, it's the president's decision to make. I know they're talking about it, but there's no real sense right now of when that time will be. You know, historically, I think it's always been done by this time, like March 15th. But the president's been a little distracted with a number of things lately, and I know this is on his agenda.
Yeah.
He will make it in due course, and we're keeping our fingers crossed.
Yeah, now it was reported yesterday that the president has said that Jimmy Carter has asked him to give his eulogy, which tells me that even he thinks the time is near. I know you have some thoughts, and you know, on his legacy. I mean, you've known the man. Thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, look, I really. He's just one of those guys. And again, I said it a moment ago, when you're my age and you grow up in a Jim Crow South, you know, your formative years early on were in a Jim Crow era. I was 9 years old when the church bombing happened that killed four little girls. I was here during, and went to segregated schools and segregated churches and saw so many things. And to see the changes and to hear a voice when I've got voices like that were the loudest voices of the day were people like George Wallace and Lester Maddox and Ross Barnett and Orville Faubus, those kind of, you know, rebel rousers, arch segregationists. And then you have a man of God, a man of faith that comes along and gets elected as governor of Georgia in 1970. And at that point, really started opening the doors to so many African Americans and the state jobs and the schools. Everything he did was about equality and justice. And he did that, and he carried that. He was true to that. He did that as president of the United States. And it was, you know, like I say, I think what's interesting, Rick, is that Jimmy Carter and others, but particularly led by Carter, turned so many pages on the Jim Crow era. Some of those pages are getting turned back right now.
Yeah, and this is the perfect time for it.
Yeah, and I think that if there is one thing that Jimmy Carter would say as in his last days, use his passing to take another look at ourselves and about how we treat each other and how we treat people. Not just races now. It's religions, it's gender, the whole nine yards.
Yeah, there you go. I'm with right there with you. I got to take a quick break here. Right back. Stick around.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1999. That was the day that Bruce Springsteen was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. 2 years later, an article in Rolling Stone magazine read, "For nearly four decades, Bruce Springsteen has been a working class hero. A plain-spoken visionary and a sincere romantic whose insights into everyday life, especially in America's small-town heartland, have earned comparison to John Steinbeck and Woody Guthrie. At the core of Springsteen's music are the struggles of working people. Often his music connects to past lyricists and novelists and the history of the working class." His 1995 album, The Ghost of Tom Joad, opens with a song about the iconic hero from Steinbeck's classic, The Grapes of Wrath. In 2006, Springsteen released an album of covers of the folk music legend Pete Seeger. In perhaps his most well-known song, Born in the USA, Springsteen tells the story of a Vietnam vet struggling to find work. In another song, he hauntingly weaves a tale of the radical conflict that emerged when Vietnamese immigrant fishermen moved into Galveston Bay, Texas. Springsteen's songs chart the history of American work, from labor on the Erie Canal to the mighty steel forges of Youngstown, Ohio. His 2012 album, Wrecking Ball, captured the devastation caused by the Great Recession of 2008.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
Not so long ago, book burnings were considered a festive group activity by assorted right-wing zealots. Today, though, burning seems so old-fashioned and, well, crude. Yet the concept is burning hotter than ever among a gaggle of testosterone-driven Republican leaders eager to show voters that they will go to extremes to incinerate progressive ideas and people's personal liberties. Rather than lighting bonfires, though, the new fad for GOP politicians is simply to use government power to ban the offending books, thus saving the expense of matches and lighter fluid. It might not surprise you to learn that our Lone Star State's extremist political operatives are leading today's book-banning frenzy. One Jonathan Mitchell, for example, is going from town to town pushing Texas Republican officeholders to pass local ordinances he labels Safe Library Patron Protection. Yes, patrons, censoring what you can read is necessary to protect you. The GOP ban prohibits libraries from having books, videos, etc. that contain, quote, immoral content, which he defines as depictions of nudity, sexual behavior, mentions of masturbation, LGBTQ life, etc. It's also autocratically homophobic, making it illegal for librarians to display LGBTQ flags. He even concocts a riot of right-wing vigilantes to enforce the ordinances, authorizing bounty hunters to roam the countryside suing local libraries and individual librarians. To spur this political malice, Mitchell's scheme provides a $10,000 reward for every violation of vigilante fines or fabricates. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, repression doesn't recognize state borders, so the pernicious idea of paid library marauders is spreading across the country. To help defend your freedom, go to American Library Association, ALA.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So there's a story over at the Hill that pointed out that the most partisan member of Congress, Marjorie Taylor Greene, has generated nearly 10 times as many mentions in press coverage in the 22 election cycle as the least member, Don Bacon, according to this new study on hyper-partisanship. And yes, of course, the loudest, most outrageous always gets the attention, which is why, again, our social media society has created this. and why we really never get to find out the middle. We never get to talk in insane ways, I think. It's always the most extreme stuff. That's why I've asked my good friend Doug Jones, former Alabama senator, to stick around and share some thoughts. Doug, appreciate you sticking around with us.
My pleasure, Rick, as always.
I bring this up because there was a situation at Stanford Law School. Maybe you saw this. Everybody wrote a piece on it. George Will had a piece. There was a piece over at The Nation. There's all this stuff about this Judge Duncan who went to speak at Stanford Law at the behest of the Federalist Society chapter there and basically was shut down by protesters who screamed a whole bunch of stuff at him. And then you had the dean of diversity, equity, and inclusion, you know, with a whole long prepared speech. And it, from the social media appearance of it, it looked like they sideswiped this guy. Me, I looked at it as going, I don't know what the point of this was. It's not moving any needles. I find both sides to be wrong in this. I wanted to get your thought as a lawyer, someone who's been in those spaces. What did you think when you saw what went on there at Stanford?
Well, you know, Rick, first of all, protests like that are is as American as apple pie. I mean, that's what not only we do, it's what our Constitution allows. And student protests like that, it's nothing new. But just because you've got a right to do it doesn't mean you should do it. And I am so I just get pissed off about the whole cancel culture that we seem to be having from both the right and the left sometime, because it is the extremes. You can protest. And I think, by the way, that Judge Duncan needed to be protested. I think he's an extremist. I think he's an embarrassment to the bench. But the Federalist Society, that's the kind of judges that they like and they want to put on. So there's that whole issue about that. So I don't mind the protest, but I do think that you don't just cancel somebody out. You don't do things. And I'm especially disappointed in Stanford's administration, the way they handled that day. I thought that was incredibly inappropriate, and they joined in the canceling essentially when they promote themselves as free speech. But you know, look, we are in a world right now, I think, that people are taking this whole thing too far. It's just to the extremes, and you saw that happen at Stanford, but yet the king of cancel culture these days is Ron DeSantis as governor of Florida. If he even tried to cancel Tinkerbell for speaking out against him, okay? He has fired prosecutors. He's fired others. He's just, it's ridiculous. So if people want to get away from that, everybody needs to just chill, let folks have their say, ask the tough questions, hold up your signs. Protest if you want to when somebody says something you disagree with, but for goodness sakes, let's at least move to where there can be a dialogue. If you don't have dialogue, Rick, you're just never going to be able to move forward. And there was no dialogue. And what I would have really liked to have seen is some of these students really challenge Judge Duncan on his facts and on the law, and not just call him names, and like Donald Trump does. And I think they could have gotten their point across much, much better if they had done that.
See, here's my point, and this is where we agree. I spent a couple of years as a bad student on a college campus who I sat and I listened to people I didn't agree with. In fact, I watched the video that was put out of the protest and of the woman who was the dean of diversity, equity, and inclusion give her spiel, but then they cut off when she was done. I wanted to hear what the judge had to say. I got to hear what the dean said. I wanted to hear what he had to say. We don't do enough of that. And this is a law school. You're the lawyer. Isn't that where you're supposed to train the next generation of statesmen and people who are going to debate even on ideas that they don't agree with? For me, the most disappointing part of that whole video was the future lawyers all had their say, and then they got up and walked out.
No, I absolutely agree. They didn't listen. And you know, Rick, what's interesting, I gave a speech to a group of lawyers a couple of months ago, trial lawyers, okay? And every day, lawyers go into courtrooms every day, and they ask judges to follow the facts and the law. They argue to the jury, set aside any biases and prejudices you have, and listen to these facts and judge the facts. But they don't do that in their personal lives. They don't do that in that law school, that auditorium that day. They didn't want to do that. They didn't want to hear and challenge those facts. And I think lawyers have a special responsibility. And I understand that this judge was terribly offensive to some of those students, a lot of those students. I get that. But you know what, Rick? There's a lot of things that are in this life that are terribly offensive. And they're never going to go away. We're going to have to deal with it. And the best thing to challenge those offensive things is to work within a system to try to make a difference. And you don't make a difference by just simply screaming and hollering and walking out.
Now, like you said, everyone has the right to protest. They have the right to do this. I look at this as someone who wants to win. I want the right side to win. And I'm looking at people who are going to see this. And because both sides are performative, they brought him there. They brought this judge there to get a reaction. That judge went there to get famous. If Trump wins, who knows? He may be up for Supreme Court at some point down the road because of this. And the left did this too for performance, to get attention, but nothing got solved. I mean, that's my problem with every single one of these issues. I bring up the transgender issue, which again, everybody's crazy about without talking about a solution. You know, I say this all the time. In my workplace 30 years ago, we dealt with this. You know, we had a guy went away. We'll call him Ross. Ross went away. He came back 6 months later. He was Rosie. Nobody cared. Did his job, did her job, went home, led her life. It wasn't the end of humanity. Now it's the end of humanity. Oh, we're doing, it's crazy because we are in our silos and nobody ever wants to come up with a solution.
No, I agree with that. I completely agree with that. And there are ways, there is common ground that can be found on just about every issue. Maybe not every issue, but there is some common ground that you can find on just about every issue if you work at it and you look at it and you talk to people. And that's what I think we've just got to figure out. But Rick, it is going to take, and I have said it on this show before, and I'll continue to say it, it is also going to take public servants and candidates willing to lead by example that way. And we don't see a lot of that. We don't see a lot of that. I guarantee you there are certain, look what happened at the President of the United States State of the Union when your friend Marjorie Taylor Greene was screaming liar, liar, liar. Of course, George Santos thought she was talking about him, but you know, it was one of those things. It's you lead by those examples and folks aren't getting a good example these days. And we need to get back to where people can agree to disagree without being disagreeable and set the example for our young people.
No, I got to tell you, if one of my kids were in that classroom and they were protesting, I'd be great. Good on you for protesting. But if I saw him leave the classroom, I would be angry because you should have sat there and at least listened and at least, you know, push back on just my thought. But your point on cancel culture is interesting because, you know, you got free speech fighter Ted Cruz, who's now telling Stanford that they should punish those students for heckling the Trump appointed judge and also fire that Stanford associate dean. While simultaneously complaining about cancel culture. I find that kind of interesting.
Yeah, well, it's not just interesting, it's bizarre. I mean, but that's it. There is no rhyme or reason to some of the things that people, that a lot of our politicians are saying about those issues because it is all or nothing for them. It is their side, it is my way or the highway, and that's the way Ted is unfortunately approaching this. He would not have done that in a different context. I think if this was Liberty University and the same thing had happened with Elizabeth Warren or somebody or a judge from who's a really liberal judge and they did the same thing, he wouldn't be saying that about those students. He wouldn't be saying that about the school administrator. I'm convinced of that. Look, there's so much now that people they go to their political corners immediately. This goes back to what we were talking about earlier about the banking thing, the whole nine yards. You know, Ben Sasse, when Ben was conservative Republican senator from Nebraska, he used a term once, and it was, I think it was about the initial whistleblower complaint that was filed against Trump in Ukraine. And he said, let's see what happens. He said, in this world of insta-certain, which means the minute you hear something on the news, you make a judgment and you stick to that judgment. And that's one of the problems that we've got with social media and everybody else these days, is that insta-certain mentality that you've got to take this position. You've got to stick to this position. Be damned with the facts.
Yeah, we are in our camps. And again, you know, today I was listening to some right-wing talk radio while I was driving, and all I kept hearing about was President Biden's comments that anti-trans laws are close to sinful. And, you know, I don't understand the whole trans issue. I'm going to be honest, I don't. I've had friends who have transitioned, and I've had conversations with them saying, look, I don't understand. I'm never going to understand, but love you. I hope this is what makes you happy. I'm hoping this is where your happiness is. God bless you. Do your thing. Never going to understand it, but I don't have to, and I'm glad I don't. I look at this moment and I listen to the vitriol coming out of the radio from these people and this intolerance. It's scary to me. And I guess I grew up in a time where life, liberty, pursuit of happiness meant something. And the Republican Party used to believe in limited, less intrusive government. I didn't realize that was amended to, well, other things.
Well, it's kind of been there under the surface all along, even when I was, you know, worked in the U.S. Senate, when, you know, issues of abortion, issues of guns, everything was, you know, limited government unless it was on an issue where they wanted government to do something in their favor. It's always kind of been there. But in today's Republican Party, it is really bubbled up, and people are tearing up the airways. They're tearing up social media. And I don't understand it either. I mean, you said a couple of things, Rick, in that last little bit. You used the term love. You used the term, you know, God bless them. You know, the same people that are, I guarantee this just about, that the same people that are tearing those folks up, that are tearing down the transgender community, will call themselves evangelicals. Well, that is not the teaching that I grew up with in the Methodist Church. It's not the teaching that I grew up with people that were Baptist. You know, it is all about love and tolerance and trying to understand. And that's the thing. You can't, if you just want to attack, you'll never understand. And the fact of the matter is, we are in a world where transgender children, transgender adults are going to be with us. They are not, that is not something you can just hide anymore. And we've got to figure out ways to do it, but that is going to take talking and discussing and trying to understand, having an open mind with it, and not just trying to lock people away for trying to discuss it with a doctor.
Yeah. No, I look at the guy who's I think he's lieutenant governor in Tennessee. I'm sure you've seen the story where on the official Instagram page, he was liking half nude pictures of young men. In fact, you know, said one of the young guys would turn a rainy day into sunshines and rainbows, and he's got an anti-gay, anti-trans past. But when he was interviewed, and this is where I think it's really important, he was interviewed and he said that he's evolved on the issue. And there's part of me that goes, as a society, can we evolve to the point to where maybe we don't hate each other as much?
Yeah, no, look, we've evolved on many issues, Rick. We evolve, we take a few steps back, we evolve some more. You know, our whole society is a work in progress. You know, our technology, as people let our technology run away with us and our emotions, and I think we'll catch up. But right now, I think social media and everything else has brought out the absolute worst in people. It is one of the greatest things that we've ever seen, but it's also has brought out the worst in so many people. But I am convinced that we will catch up. I am convinced that there are people out there, and as these younger folks grow into this with social media, they're going to see things for what they are. They're going to see it in a different way, and we will evolve. We've gotten in for some choppy water still, but I still have a lot of hope in this country. I wish people would get more civically engaged in a respectful way. I think that will help us evolve much, much quicker.
So what's the positive message going forward? I mean, we've gone through a bunch of topics, the banking situation, the Atlanta, maybe the DNC is going to have their convention, and what positive? I want to leave somebody with a positive message because you always inspire me. I'm curious, you got a positive word?
Well, I can always say a positive word about the Alabama basketball team. He was number one seed in the NCAA tournament, but we won't go there. Okay. We won't go there because I never know what's going to happen. But, you know, Rick, look, I continue to look around and I see so many things that people ought to be so proud of. And if we could just get past the political one-upsmanship and look at what we've done in the last few years, look how we came out of COVID after some really fits and starts, in a bad way, and over a million people lost their lives. But we've been able to come out of that. We've been able to come out of it. We have produced more jobs in the last couple of years than in God knows how long. Look at the manufacturing jobs, all your union buddies out there who are getting good paying jobs again because we're bringing jobs to this country. Our unemployment is low. Are there still choppy waters ahead of us? Absolutely. There's no question about that. But at the same time, we have so much to be thankful for in this country. We have brought our allies together to fight for democracy when we thought democracy was on its last leg. And now it's got a second wind. And we're getting it more and more every day with a war in Ukraine. So I'm always a glass half full guy, Rick. I like to think that we're as the president says, better than anybody. You know, there is just nothing that this country can't do if we put our mind to it and we work together. And we've done it before. And I got a feeling we're going to get there. We're getting there slowly but surely. And we're going to get there. And I really think we'll get there a lot quicker if the DNC goes to Atlanta.
See, I got to tell you, every time I hear you speak, I go, there's a guy who's got to run for something. We got to get you to run for something.
Been there, done that. We'll see how it goes in the future.
There you go, Doug. I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Always, Rick. Thank you.
Good stuff. Former Alabama Senator Doug Jones. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back to wrap things up after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Okay. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1887. This was the day the International Brotherhood of Painters and Decorators of America got their start, issuing their first charter. John Elliott led the founding meeting. Prior to moving to Maryland, Elliott had been involved in painters unionizing efforts since the 1870s in New York. He was a strong advocate of the eight-hour workday. In Baltimore, he founded Painters Local Union No. 1. Elliott called the meeting to discuss forming a national painters trade union. Local Union No. 1 chartered 15 more locals, from Pensacola, Florida to Peoria, Illinois. Painters in Toronto, Canada were also granted a charter, making the fledgling union a true international union. During the first year of operation, the union grew to represent 7,000 workers from 100 local unions. As membership continued to grow, so did the union's collective power. The painters union became known for their exceptional skill and quality craftsmanship. By 1918, the union had won the important victories of the 8-hour day and a 5-day work week for its members. By the 1920s, the union had grown to represent more than 100,000 workers. The painters, like many other unions, saw hard time during the Great Depression. As construction projects dwindled, union membership fell by nearly half. During World War II, union membership surged again, reaching as many as 145,000 members. The union painters worked on many government projects as valued craftsmen for the war effort. Today,
the union is known as the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, with a membership of 160,000 current workers and retirees. These men and women include painters, drywall finishers, wall coverers, glazers, glass workers, floor covering installers, sign makers, display workers, and convention and show decorators. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. I want to get to a couple of quick emails I got during the break. Darren says, I agree that we should bail out the banks, or better said, the people that work for them, Obama and or the Muslim socialists bailed out GM. Of course, flipped us the bird. and went more overseas with factories to fuel trade deals. He passed greed all around. Okay. thanks, Darren. BJ writes, hey, Rick, I'm voting for all of the above. Get the bonuses back, town square, and tarred and feather. Okay, yeah, I'm not against that either. Wendy from Central Point, Oregon writes, OMG, I just ran across your show, and I want to tell you I love it. Great, I'm thrilled to hear that. You're saying exactly what I've been preaching for years and thought I was just over the top. God bless you and keep it up. Lifelong Teamster. Well, my Teamster sister, thanks for tuning in. Also, Joy in Lone Pine, California. She points out, I hope I got your email well enough. I'm a fan of yours and so grateful for the passion and clear way you express the working class and low-income people. Our leaders continue to lack empathy and heart to care about us. But for a few exceptions, I feel that we continue to be invisible in the wealthiest country. We're insulted by the few crumbs that the system, including Social Security, provides. When will society wake up and care enough to get informed again? Deep thanks, Rick, for your voice and your program for speaking up on our behalf and doing it so well. Well, thank you, Joy. This is one of those things that we don't have enough working class voices. And this is why, you know, the banking thing to me is important. Just like in 2008 and 2009, it was all about, you know, how do we save the banks from collapsing? And I was talking about, how do we save the workers from losing their jobs? And we never really had a serious discussion of what I would have liked to have seen, which were a lot of retreads from the FDR era, the Home Loan Ownership Corporation that bought up a bunch of homes to keep people in their houses so that they would weather out the storm and not be homeless and not cause the ripple effect of losses. Keep people attached to their jobs by cutting down the number of hours per week and setting up an unemployment kind of system to make up the differences. There were policies we could be moving. We just don't, because corporate America doesn't want to. Now, the great thing coming out of this pandemic, and there's a lot of good stuff. The great thing coming out of this pandemic is we've got a generation, the millennials, who are big enough to go, you know what? We're tired of getting screwed over. We want change. And you've got a younger generation who really doesn't care because they've watched their parents and the millennials get screwed over. And they're like, why should we bother? Corporate America kind of has to change. Policymakers are going to have to change. Working class issues are going to have to be addressed. Finally. You know, I've been talking about a lot of the issues that are front and center now for all 18 years of doing this show. The idea of taking on China, some of the stuff we talked about in the first week on the air because of the job losses and the communities that were being affected. None of these stories are new. I'm glad people are coming on board. I'm glad the awakening is happening. But we've got to take this and we've got to move it into a real political victory realm. Which is why all of the performative stuff, all of the stuff that's meant to divide us, all of these shows of, you know, the extremes, you know, pitting against the middle, we got to put that out. We've got to ignore that stuff and come together. And as I say, you know, take off the red hat and the blue hat and put on a hard hat. We've got to rebuild this country. And we do it in a way with values that ensure that working people finally get a fair shake. That's what we should be doing. And that whole thing that I used to believe in when I grew up in school, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. My conservative friends, maybe you've heard of it. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, make sure you download the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to The Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at TheRickSmithShow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Good morning. You're tuned to 99.5 FM, WPAI in New York. The Rick Smith Show came to you on recording over listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WPAI in New York. Coming up at 8 o'clock is Any Sanity with David Rothenberg. So please stay tuned.
Hey, Maya, guess what? Kylie Jenner's new lip kit is out.
Mercedes, are you really going to spend your money on that garbage?
It's not garbage. She finally released a color I've been looking for, ginger.
Mercedes, you can do so much more.
Like what?
You can donate it to WBAI and become a BAI buddy.
What's a BAI buddy?
A BAI buddy is someone who signs up to make a monthly donation to WBAI. Once you join, you'll receive a BAI buddy card and a free tote bag. The BAI buddy card allows you to become eligible for on-air giveaways and receive discounts at local shops, museums, and venues. And that's not even the best part. You can get all of this and more by donating as little as $10 a month.
That sounds amazing. I want to become a BAI buddy. How can I join?
You can sign up at WBAI.org.
WBAI.org? Got it. Thanks. And you're right, I can do a lot more at WBAI than with Kylie Jenner.
It's all about supporting a medium that keeps it 100.
He's cool. He's exciting.
This dude is bad.
He's sexy. Okay, maybe not. He's a bad mother.
Shut your mouth.
He's Tony Ryan. On WBAI New York 99.5 FM. He's got both.
Frank Kemp with the sound of the trumpet.
Can you dig it?
Yeah, I can dig it, yeah.
He's got classic soul. He's okay. I can't think of anything else.
I'm Tony Ryan. Tune in Saturday nights, 10 p.m. to 1 a.m.
Soul Central Station with Tony Ryan.
99.5 WBAI.
The next WBAI Community Advisory Board meeting is on Sunday, March 19th at 1 p.m. You are invited to attend. The CAB, or CAB, is an advisory board which reviews programming and other station policies. It represents the diverse views and interests of the communities WBAI serves. If you want to attend the meeting, you can join by teleconference at 619-309-1058. And the PIN number is 641-711. Everyone is invited to call in and join the meeting, and we're happy that more people are now attending CAB meetings. Once again, the call-in number is 619-309-1058, and the PIN number 641-711. We hope that you'll be able to attend. That's the Community Advisory Board meeting, WBAI, March 19th, Sunday, 1 p.m.
This is Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black Will 21st Century. April 19th through the 23rd, all roads lead to Baltimore, the State of the Black Will Conference 5. Organized around the theme, Global Africans Rising, Empowerment, Reparations, and Healing, to address eight major issue areas, reimagining policing, gun violence and fratricide, gentrification, environmental justice, water as a human right, socially responsible entrepreneurship, making Black Lives Matter, the role of hip-hop in the Black freedom struggle, and building the U.S. and global reparations movements. The who's who of Black America and the Pan-African world will be in Baltimore April 19th to the 23rd for one of the great gatherings of Black people of the century. To check out the amazing program and take advantage of discount registration, go to the website IBW21.org. That's IBW21.org.
This is WBAI, and this is Fred Eagle Smith for WBAI in New York. Stick it in your ear.
All right.